Encrypted. We have a great show today with Bonnie Florek, with spooks and legends and ghost stories and fun things from Williamsburg. David Redding, our co-host, is on vacation today, and I hope you're having fun, Dave. I'm sure you are. Before we get started with our interview with Bonnie, though, I want to mention that our last show was canceled. Due to the fact that we were going to interview Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. regarding his book, The Roswell Legacy. I highly recommend that. It's The Roswell Legacy by Jesse Marcel Jr. and Linda Marcel, his wonderful wife. Sadly, Mr. Marcel passed away before we were able to tape the interview. That he passed away, of course, is a huge sad event. He was a wonderful man and played a major part in the UFO world, especially, of course, with Roswell. So we're going to play a short soundbite in memory of Jesse Marcel Jr. right now.
My story for the Roswell part began in the wee hours in the morning of July 1947, when I was awakened by my dad, who was returning from an assignment to collect debris of unknown origin from a ranch out of Roswell. The sheriff in Chavez County contacted Colonel Blanchard, who was the commander of the Air Force Base in Roswell. Now, Colonel Blanchard knew my dad was the intelligence officer, so he dispatched my dad and a CIC agent, Sheridan Cavett, to investigate what this was. Our house happened to be on the way to the base, and this is in the wee hours of the morning. So my dad, knowing that he had seen something very special, wanted my mother and myself to look at this also, because as he said, you'll never see this again. So what he did, he stopped off at the house, awakened my mother and myself, and again, the wee hours in the morning. It's summertime. I've been playing all day with the bicycles and things like that. I was 11 years old at the time, however. And he brought us into the kitchen and saw a smattering of this strange debris on the kitchen floor that he had pre-positioned. He said, look at this. I think this is what you call a flying saucer or remains thereof. The debris itself consisted of three components, three types. There was a foil, a very tough metallic foil of some nature that I can't really describe. If you fold it over, it would unfold and assume its original form. In addition, there was black plastic debris, like a broken phonograph record. But the strangest thing I saw was, as being passed around right now, was that this is a replica of one of the I-beams, or the beams I saw in the wreckage. In that, you'll note there's some symbols written along the inside surface of this, and they're a purplish violet hue, semi-reflective of light. My dad drove the debris into the base that night. I think it was that night, or maybe early next morning, where he was assigned by Dr. or Colonel Blanchard to fly the material to General Ramey's office in Fort Worth. This was flown in the belly of a B-29 under armed guard. That's where the cover began, in General Ramey's office. So when my dad got home, he sat my mother and myself down and said, in no uncertain terms, you will never talk about this. This is a non-event.
Is there anything else you can share with us of your impressions and knowledge of an 11-year-old boy?
Well, it was a very earth awakening experience, or space awakening experience for me. It did make this very interested in astronomy and cosmology, because I realized that whatever was on the kitchen floor didn't come from here, but came from out there.
What else should we know before we get up from here today?
Well, I think what it does, it tells us that we are not alone in the universe. As a matter of fact, there's other civilizations out there, and they're finding Earth-like planets around other star systems every day. Any civilization that develops into space travel has gone through a nuclear age, and we're still on the precipice of either surviving or not surviving ours, but it means they did. And if they can do it, we can also survive our nuclear warlike tendencies. Well, as a 76-year-old, you know, I'm no spring chicken. But I like to tell my story. I don't embellish it. I tell exactly what I knew about this. And if people want to believe this, that's okay. If they don't want to believe it, that's also okay. That's their opinion. I would certainly like to have the government spill the beans about this while I'm still alive to say, I told you so. But I may not be, but it doesn't matter. I've been there and done that, so I know it was.
This is Lorette Love with Encrypted. Again, that was Jesse Marcel Jr., his book, The Roswell Legacy. I highly recommend it. Our interview today is with Bonnie Florek, and her website is www.spooksandlegends.com. That's www.spooksandlegends.com. And Bonnie's tour of Williamsburg is number one on TripAdvisor for haunted tours of Williamsburg, a huge honor. And Bonnie, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you for inviting me to share with your audience not only about Spooks and Legends tours, but also about the town history of Williamsburg. I appreciate that.
Well, it's our pleasure, and Williamsburg is so vital to our country. I mean, that was one of the first cities, I believe, or towns that we had established in America, wasn't that so?
Well, it is true, and Williamsburg is full of rich history. Yet I'm always amazed at how few people are familiar with the town's importance, actually. Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, and George Washington are just a few of the many of our forefathers who walked the very streets of Williamsburg. They say that if they were to come back to town today, it would not look much different than it looked when they were here years ago. The only exception would be that the roads were not paved then, of course, and horses would have been hitched right up to the dirt-paved doorsteps. Through extensive research and archaeological digs, which go on all the time here in Williamsburg, these buildings and homes and shops have been restored or reconstructed to be just as they were in the 18th century. It's a beautiful town, and I can tell you firsthand that it's an amazing feeling to know that when you walk through the town, you are walking where these very famous and important men walked almost 2.5 centuries ago.
Yeah,
of course,
that's amazing.
This was not the first capital of Virginia. It all began in 1607, of course, when the first English-speaking settlers landed in Jamestown, and that remained the capital until 1699. Many people have been taught over the years, myself included, that the Pilgrims were the first to settle in America in Plymouth, Massachusetts. But I certainly was taught, being from the North, that that was the case, but it is not. The Pilgrims did not arrive until 1620, 13 years after those in Jamestown. The first settlers of Virginia made the decision in 1699 to move the capital further inland, not only for safety reasons, but because the water on the James River was brackish, and certainly they didn't want to get ill. They had worked very, very hard to remain well enough to keep the colony going here, and they did not want to be sick or to be attacked by any kinds of ships that would come into the James River area or the York River. So the State House had also burned four times when they decided to move the capital to what was then called Middle Plantation. Of course, in Middle Plantation, the College of William and Mary had already been established in 1693, as was the Bruton Parish Church. But the town was also situated further inland from the James and York rivers, making it much less prone to attack than Jamestown had been. So they were very happy to go to Middle Plantation. But they did change the name of Middle Plantation to Williamsburg after King William's, King William, and it did remain the new capital. The small town was quickly transformed into a really brilliant and vibrant 18th century city, and the House of Burgesses met in the Capitol building that still stands today, soon built after their arrival. The town, during the Revolutionary years, grew to a population of 2,000, half being slaves. So there were a lot of gentry and middling sort and lesser sort, and, of course, indentured servants and slaves as well. The town was very eclectic, though it was considered a very big city at the time. By 1780, it was decided to move the state capital to Richmond, where it has remained, of course, today. Thomas Jefferson was the governor at that time and felt it would be safer to move the capital inland from the rivers again. But looking back, it was the best decision that could have ever been made. Of course, Williamsburg would have not remained in the 18th century condition had the capital remained in the town. The buildings and homes certainly would have been torn down for newer structures and would not have been the beautiful historic town we now have. But there are 88 original buildings in town, which is amazing after all these years, and over 350 total buildings that have been reconstructed on original foundations, and that is why the town looks so like it did in the 18th century.
Wow, that's amazing that you could just walk down the street knowing that Thomas Jefferson saw basically the same thing you're seeing.
Well, that's true, and I absolutely love walking the streets in Williamsburg because of that. There's such a feeling of peace there, like I've never known anywhere else. I've lived in many other cities and states, and I just love it here. There's always been a feeling of comfort here for some reason for me, as many other people say. I visited Williamsburg from the time I was about 4 years old, and ever since that time, I always wanted to make this my home, and I won't tell you how many years it took me to get here, but I certainly am grateful that I am, and I certainly do not want to ever leave. I always say I'm not going to, and that they'll have to carry me out of here if they want me to go. I just love Williamsburg. Now, the restoration came about because Reverend W.A.R. Goodwin was the rector of the Bruton Parish Church in 1923, and he wanted to see the town go back to the way it had been during the Revolution. So, of course, he needed financial backing to realize that dream. He sought out several different people, I think Mr. Ford, all different people. But then he ended up speaking with Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and after some prompting and persuading, Mr. Rockefeller did agree to back the restoration. And then, of course, when Reverend Goodwin died some years later, he was laid to rest in a place of honor, which was just behind the altar inside the Bruton Parish Church, where there are many other people buried under the floor as well, which makes it a very interesting place to walk. It's kind of like the cathedrals in New York City, where they often have bodies buried beneath the floor. Now, Duke of Gloucester Street, which is the main thoroughfare in town, was named after the Duke of Gloucester, which his name was Prince William Henry, the oldest son of Princess Anne, who died at the young age of 9. We call it Dog Street today, which is short for Duke of Gloucester, but it is also a name we call it because there are so many people from the area who walk their dogs down the main road there and visit each morning. And I used to take a lot of walks there in the early morning, and you get to know all the townspeople and the area people who live here and their dogs, and you give each other dog treats, and it's really a fun place to be, and everybody looks out for you. If they haven't seen you for a while, you know, they're happy to ask you if everything's all right, and it's just a nice, comfortable feeling to know that people really do care, and they do here. It's a very, very nice, warm town. That street is exactly 1 mile long, so many people who walk, who want to look after their health, know how long they've walked and how what the distance has been. But the town was built on three very important principles, which was based around that main road. Education, of course, with the college being on the east end of town, and then government with the capital on the west end of town, and the Bruton Parish Church, which was halfway between, represented, of course, religion. The street had been designed by the governor at the time, who was Francis Nicholson. And the interesting thing about Mr. Nicholson is that he had also designed Annapolis, Maryland. He loved symmetry, and I understand Annapolis is the same way, that everything is very symmetrical. So Duke of Gloucester Street was made straight immediately. He didn't like the curve in the road, so unfortunately they had removed some of the streets, some of the homes that were on the street to make the road straight. And then Mr. Nicholson also named the streets just to the north and south of the main road after himself, as he had also done in Annapolis. I guess he thought a lot of himself, which is fine. But the streets are named Francis and Nicholson, which is interesting. So yeah, people that visit here from Annapolis say, gee, you have the same names of the streets that we have. And I guess it's because Mr. Nicholson did think a lot of himself. But in October 1934, this is also a very nice thing. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt came here for some celebration of the college. And they took him for a ride down Duke of Gloucester Street, and they did call it the most, he did call it the most historic avenue in America. And it has remained so. And we are very proud of the town here. And I can't tell you how much I enjoy walking down those streets and giving tours and taking people to where those forefathers walked so long ago. It means a lot to them, too, when they understand. You know, many people, when they come to a tour, they think they're coming for just a ghost tour, something like a haunted house that you would see at Busch Gardens or other place. But it is not that way. You know, these tours are based on rich history as well as researched ghost stories. And when I explain to them what the town is really about, they are so amazed, and they understand better. And then they can't wait to come back the next day to go for a true history walk and to go in the buildings and learn the old crafts. And it is a wonderful town, and I always encourage people to visit and feel very badly when they don't even know of it. So I hope others will now hear about it and visit, certainly.
Well, I agree, and that's why I invited you on. I think Americans should really know about Williamsburg. It's such an important area. Now, tell us about your tour. It's called Legends. Legends.
Yes, it
correct.
Is. And
so you have two types of tours: a ghost tour and also a history tour.
Yes, I will give. We do have group history tours that we will give during the day if people want them, or at night. But most people, they will come here and get history tours through Colonial Williamsburg, though I do have some who request a history tour. Most, if they want a history tour, they'll go through Colonial Williamsburg. But not only that, they have an overview that you can hear about Williamsburg, just going to that overview. And then you go to various towns and various shops and buildings in town where there are interpreters who are dressed in costume, and they tell all about the town. So you get a lot of history just by visiting the buildings themselves. Sometimes I'll give an overview tour, and then people go back and visit the buildings after they know a little bit about each one. But there are many, many buildings to visit, and people just learn so much about the old crafts and about the way of life. But I do enjoy giving the tours in the evening, and being down there at night is especially nice. I've been out there in all kinds of weather, and last year we even had a snow while I was out there, and I came back Having worn a red cape on the way out, I came back with a white one, but it was beautiful, a beautiful night to be out there, and every season is so beautiful in town.
So that's great. Now, tell me then, or tell us about your ghost tours, because the title of your business is Spooks and Legends, so I'm guessing...
Well, it was always a dream of mine, of course, to live and work in Williamsburg. I had no idea about ghost tours or other. When I was very little, I don't think that there were even ghost tours that you heard much about, but they're a very, very big thing in this country and in the world right now. But I had first visited around the age of four, and it took many years, which I won't tell you how many, but many years for me to finally have the opportunity to move here to this town, which was 11 years ago. And so when I first moved to Williamsburg, I worked for Colonial Williamsburg as a history interpreter and as an evening tour guide. I also worked for another private tour company in town, and I loved all my work. The private tour company, I did history tours, but also mostly ghost tours, and especially enjoyed those. But I had some original ideas for a different and unique kind of tour that hadn't been given by any other tour in town, and I decided that I would venture out and put a tour together of my own. I remembered what guests had told me they wanted in other tours, and they were a bit disappointed, and so I have addressed those issues to create something that the guests will not be disappointed in and will really enjoy. In 2010, Spooks and Legends began, and it has gained in popularity and the reputation of being the most enjoyable tour to go on, which I'm very, very proud of and very pleased with. I want nothing more than to make my guests completely happy, of course. But it's been a lot of fun and wonderful to hear so many guests regarding how pleased they are that ours are not based on history, but on fully researched ghost stories. Now, don't misunderstand, there is history in our tours. But the history pertains to the ghost stories or the homes we visit. And, it is not just based on history and with a little bit of ghost story thrown in, because that's not what people expect in a ghost tour. So, all of our characters play the parts of an authentic revolutionary resident from town. And other than the main tour guide, who would be me, who plays the part of Catherine Rissell, a town milliner, there are two other characters employed to meet the tour group along the way and interact with our guests. They tell their stories from the ghostly character's perspective as well. For instance, there is a good friend of mine. His name is Fred Vick, and he's the owner of American Guided Tours here in town as well. But we now work together, and he plays one of our characters and is such an asset to this business, I can't even tell you. He always interprets his character in a fun and engaging way. As a matter of fact, one night someone ran back to give him a tip, and he later told me about it, even though he's only part of the tour for a few minutes. And I didn't get a tip that night, so that tells you just how much of an asset he is to the business. But he is now playing the part of Peter Pelham, who was not only the town jailkeeper, but the church organist as well, which is quite a combination. Having a rather large family, of course, Mr. Pelham needed two jobs to make ends meet, which is pretty much the same today with the way our economy is. But our guests always enjoy his visits, and his character was known to be a drinker, so it's often fun because he explains how he had misplaced criminals, and he tells our groups to be careful because there are people who were missing from the jail that evening. But he speaks of his love for rum punch, and of course at that point I, as Catherine Rissell, reprimand him of his professional responsibility and safe jailkeeping, and of course the groups enjoy that as well. But Fred and I have a lot of fun doing these tours together and are constantly surprising one another with comments. We make off the cuff, trying to catch each other off guard, but somehow we always do respond in a way that seems planned. But it makes the whole interaction seem so real that our guests believe Fred, it truly is Mr. Pelham, I believe, by the end of the interaction. But I appreciate his willingness always to step in, even at the last minute. He is always there for me, even on an unexpected tour, despite the fact he lives 45 minutes away. That tells you how much he truly does love Williamsburg. his wife, Betty, even has been a wonderful help. I mean, people who are into these tours just really enjoy them. And she even signs guests in sometimes for me and always is willing to come along with Fred to support us both. And I appreciate all she does. I truly do. But I also want to make mention here that Fred and I don't only do the tours. We also offer interactive breakfast with a ghost programs to area bed and breakfasts, which is a lot of fun. The people get to interact with a character of their choice. We do offer many. And we also offer other mealtime venues, or we just do interactive programs for groups in the area as well. And again, we have a wide array of characters to choose from for all the programs and presentations that we give. But we also, this is a really fun part. There's a cat that roams the streets of Williamsburg, and Mr. Pelham, or Fred Vick, calls him Tom, short for Thomas Jefferson. I call him Jeff. But we call him Thomas Jefferson because we have him play the part of a ghost who returns from the past. And we mentioned that he was named by Mr. Witt after his prized pupil, Thomas Jefferson. And when we introduced Tom or Jeff, whichever you want to call him, we mentioned that he was unfortunately run over by Mr. Witt's coachman years ago, and that he comes back to visit with the guests. And the guests seem to really enjoy that, and he's a very friendly cat, so they all pick him up and love on him a bit, and then we let him run off, and he seems to follow us through town most of the time. But he's a lot of fun, and the guests do enjoy him. He's an extra character that I don't even have to pay for, which is a real treat. But then we have another character, and his name is Jay Romano, and he has been playing Dr. McKenzie most recently. He interacts with the group as a very prominent doctor during the Revolution, and he also asks for volunteers to have their teeth extracted by a tooth key or sawed out of their mouth. Of course, some of the volunteers decide not to follow him back to his office at the end of the interaction. But Jay has been a fake help for Spooks and Legends. He's been there since its inception and has been a very faithful and vital part of the business as well. But I tell you, there are so many good things that happen in town that we're always surprised by what we might see or hear.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. And the interactive breakfasts and other events sound really innovative also. I really, next time I go to Williamsburg, I've never been there, but when I do go, actually, I'd love to take a tour and have a breakfast or a meal with one of your players. That would be fun. We're going to take a commercial break, and when we come back, I want to talk about ghost stories, which I guess is the heart of your tours. And so we'll do that in a minute.
That'll be great.
Long before you and I were ever born, a mystery was hidden. A code was devised. A secret was guarded. It is encrypted. The truth about the Holy Grail. Who is 666? What is the elixir of life? What really happened on 12/21/12? What astonishing secret is hidden in the Declaration of Independence? What if everything you learned about history, everything you believed about reality, everything you trusted for your future is a lie? What if the truth is encrypted? EncryptedTheBook.com. Every day, 80 children and adults are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Know the warning signs. Extreme thirst, frequent urination, sudden weight loss, For more information, go to jdrfbayarea.org. That's jdrfbayarea.org.
Lamas Nike Drugane Drogi Kangaluba Dei Salakabashu.
As many as 3 million children and adults have type 1 diabetes. Join JDRF and help support the research that is delivering better treatments and ultimately a cure. Go to jdrfbayarea.org.
This is Lorette Love with Encrypted. We're interviewing Bonnie Florek, and her website is www.spooksandlegends.com. spooksandlegends.com, and she has a wonderful tour of Williamsburg. We are going to pick up now with Bonnie again and talk about ghost stories, the heart of her tours. Hi, Bonnie.
Hey. Well, you know, Spooks and Legends tours, they're all based on fully researched ghost stories, as I think I mentioned earlier. But each tour, many of our guests return to the sites we visited that night because there are so many good ghost stories that have been told, and they certainly want to go back and see what they might be able to experience for themselves and the hauntings that take place in the late night. Some ghostly sightings and sounds are experienced during the tour as well, though, you know, we never can plan those. It is nothing that's planned or created ever in our tours, which is why it makes it... It's so much more fun and truly authentic and real. The town is very haunted, and as is much of Virginia. Many were buried behind their own shops and homes, and during the years of the Revolution, which adds to the reputation and the feeling of our town. Our tour takes you to the most haunted house in Virginia, which most people know about, even if they don't know much about Williamsburg. It has quite a reputation. It's called the Peyton Randolph House, and I can tell you firsthand of the many scary things that do happen there, as can our guests and town security guards. So it is a fun one. Everyone looks forward to going there. Many of the hauntings we speak of during our tours, and there's another house called the George Witt House as well, which also has a very haunted reputation. But I'll tell you a bit about Mr. Witt's house first, as he was a very interesting man, and few people know about him either, and I find that quite interesting, as Mr. George Witt was one of many of our country's very important forefathers. He was the clerk of the House of Burgesses. He signed the Declaration of Independence. He framed the Constitution. He was the first lawyer and first judge in America, the first law professor at the College of William and Mary, and he taught Thomas Jefferson law. Well, when I ask if anyone knows of him, on our tours, no one knows. I mean, maybe I'll have 1 month who knows who he is, but they don't know all about him. They've just heard his name since they've, you know, visited the town. But his law library was left to Thomas Jefferson, as they were very good friends after he had taught Thomas Jefferson law. The two libraries combined became the nucleus of the Library of Congress today. Well, Mr. Witt lived to be 80 years of age, which at that time was a very elderly age, but he was very healthy, and he was very wealthy as well. Because of that, he had left his inheritance to a grandnephew, Mr. George Witt Sweeney. He was a ne'er-do-well. I'd say he were a ne'er-do-well on my tours, and so I just did the same thing to you, but he was a ne'er-do-well, and Mr. Witt knew that, but he hoped that if he left everything to Mr. Witt, he would, you know, grow and mature and, you know, take care of what was left. But he was in a lot of problems. He had gambled what little money he had away, and he had no way to pay those he had gambled with and those he owed. So he decided to take Mr. Witt's life in his own hands. He gave him arsenic in his tea and killed him. Well, Mr. Witt lived long enough to summon his lawyer to his bedside and change his will, so that the nephew never got anything. But because of a law that Mr. Witt helped to create that said that no black person could testify against a white person in the court of law, the nephew literally got away with murder. So it's since that time that Mr. Witt is often seen in that house, and actually he's often seen with Mr. Washington as well, as they both were very good friends, and Mr. Washington had used Mr. Witt's house during the Battle of Yorktown as his headquarters. But, you know, besides Mr. Witt dying, Michael Brown, one of Mr. Witt's 15-year-old slaves, was also accidentally poisoned and died. And his free slave, Lydia Broadnax, lost her eyesight due to the poisoning as well. And Mr. Jefferson was kind enough later to buy her glasses so that she could see, as she could not, of course, afford those for herself. But the Colonial Williamsburg security guards report concern about being in the George Witt house alone in the night. Years ago in the 18th century, there was a woman named Lady Anne Skipwith who visited the house. She was a gentrywoman, and she was there with her husband Peyton and her sister Jean. They were going to the palace for the governor's ball, and Mr. Witt was kind enough to allow them to stay in his house for a few days. But in the middle of the ball, Lady Anne was upset when she realized her husband was not paying a bit of attention to her. She was used to having a lot of attention. She was so very beautiful, of course, but this really bothered her. So he wasn't dancing with her, actually wasn't dancing with anyone other than her sister. So Lady Anne ran from the palace unattended back to Mr. Witt's house as quickly as she could. But at that time, as she ran, she lost one of her little red slippers, as it is broken. So today I always tell my guests that if they go up to the door, as I've been told by my security guards over there as well, that this is true, that if you go up to the front door and you knock on the house door in the late night and you say, Lady Anne, I have found your slipper, you will hear her run down the stairs to fetch it from you. Now,
wow.
Isn't that neat? It's just such a neat thing. If people can't... They can't wait to go back and try it. But it's also been reported that she is known to jiggle the doorknob trying to come out to fetch the slipper personally. And it's interesting, too, that guests have called me after the tour, very excited, to tell me that they indeed went back to the house and tried calling for Lady Anne, at which time they told me they almost fell off the front steps full of fear when they actually did hear her run below stairs inside the house. Many of the guests have told me they have truly heard that when they have gone back. But it's also interesting that there's a very eerie cellar in that house. Doors are heard slamming late into the night over and over. And they happen to be in a cellar where there is a clear liquid that oozes from the walls, and no one knows what it is. So it's a very interesting house, and people love to go back and try to experience things firsthand if they have not already seen some of the things on the tour. Another thing about the house is that there are shutters that are inside the windows. They open and close on their own, just little at a time, and there's absolutely no logical explanation of why it happens, but I know it personally to be true. When I first moved here, I went over and just happened to take some pictures of those windows. I'm not even sure why I did, but I thought I'd go over and take some photos to keep. And I knew nothing about the shutter story, of course, but I stood there and I took pictures over and over and over of certain windows. But when I got back home, I brought them up close and looked, and indeed, those windows were open at different distances on the inside between photos. So I mentioned to someone else in town who also gave tours, and she told me that that is a common occurrence in the house and that everyone knows that that happens. So there are plenty of things to be seen and heard in town, that is for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. And there's one thing that I want to talk about a little bit before we end here, because we have about 10 minutes before we have to wrap up. We just flew by this hour. But it's about the vault, and we may have to do a whole show on this. However, I'd like you to just, you know, give a, you know, Vault 101 talk here for everyone who's never heard of it, and maybe we could do another show and really go into it more.
Well, that would be great. It is an interesting story, and not much is said about it, so you literally have to dig to find the information, as I think you are aware of, Lorette. But there is a vault that has been called the Missing Vault at the Bruton Parish Church Cemetery, which is the church that's in Williamsburg, of course. It has created international media attention. I knew very little about it. As I said, I've had to really look into information. They do keep it very quiet, and only do you find much out if you speak with the right people or you find the right books to read. But on November 27th, 1991, it was around 4:30 in the morning when a Colonial Williamsburg security guard was patrolling along Duke of Gloucester Street past the church cemetery there. He heard a noise in the graveyard and shined a flashlight at two men who had picks and shovels in their hands, and they were digging huge holes around centuries-old graves. When the light hit them, they dropped their tools, of course, not wanting to be caught, and they jumped over the brick wall to escape. The officer went to the site of the activity and stared into the bottom of a 7.5-foot-deep pit. Now, this was the second attempt at an illegal entry into the sacred grounds of the church in 2 months. The previous time this happened was in the dark morning hours of September 9, 1991, when they had been interrupted by authorities as well. The perpetrators were identified as being a trio of New Age activists from Santa Fe, New Mexico, 39-year-old Marcia Middleton, her husband Frank Flint, and Doug Moore. They were driven by their profound belief that a secret vault lay buried deep in the corner of the cemetery, a vault which they felt held invaluable papers that would provide guidance to a new world order. They were determined to uncover the buried vault, even after being caught in the September dig and threatened with prosecution if they ever returned. They came back to search again in November anyway, and Mrs. Middleton said they were guided to come back by a biblical passage in the book of Revelations, which says, "We have to stand up for what we believe, and now is true." They believed that the mystical vault, of course, which they said was secretly buried in the early colonial days, contained copper cylinders holding the lost manuscripts of Sir Francis Bacon, a brilliant philosopher and scientist who was born in England 1561 and died in 1626. These papers were said to hold the key for a new united world and would be a precursor to the second coming of Jesus Christ. It was also speculated that the manuscripts would prove that Bacon was actually the author of the great works that have been attributed to William Shakespeare. Since that time, of course, there have been many attempts at finding that vault. As a matter of fact, some digs were done with the knowledge and blessing of the church, but each time those watching over these digs would suddenly order the pit be closed back up as soon as it looked like something was actually there. There may never be an answer to this mystery, but there are many who are certain it exists. They have since, just to let you know, they have since gated off part of the cemetery. They say that the reason they have done that is because the stones are wearing down from people touching them, walking on them, and so forth, and they are very, very old. However, my thought is that they have gated it in to try to keep people from being able to go in and dig. They also used to keep the cemetery gates unlocked day and night, which they no longer do. And so I am certain that they do not want anyone else to be digging. More of this information comes out all the time, and I'm certain they're afraid that someone else is going to do the same thing without their knowledge. They seem pretty fearful about letting information out, which tells you that certainly we need to be looking more into it, I'm sure. But, you know, the interest in the vault came about after studying many clubs or societies that seemed to be part of the secret that was hidden. The Flat Hat Society was the first secret society in the United States, and it began here in Williamsburg. It was named by outsiders, of course, because of the hats they wore, which looked like graduation caps made of mortarboard. They met regularly at the Raleigh Tavern in Williamsburg, which was later rebuilt on its original foundation in 1932, as it had burned in a fire before that. But Jefferson was the most famous member of the Flathead Society, and they met for, they say they met for drinking and discussion. Jefferson wrote in a letter that the society served no useful object and was not a scholarly pastime. The group died within two decades due to the Civil War, but it has seen recent revivals, and there, even though the interest it had waned in the 1770s, the PDA, it was called, now referred to as the Phi Delta Alpha. They also called that the Please Don't Ask at that time. They established themselves to be a secret society after the Fly Hat Society had been dismissed. But today the College of William and Mary has a student paper that is actually called the Fly Hat News. So I think it's interesting that they keep that name alive. It's kind of it's a neat name. But the Masons, you know, are also thought to be privy to the information in that buried vault. And they still meet in the Masonic Hall in Williamsburg. It dates back to the 1730s and is the oldest surviving Masonic charter in Virginia. In early years, they met in one of the town taverns, which was really more of an inn at the time. When we talk about the taverns in town, they weren't like taverns and bars you think of today. They were places where people would come into town. In Williamsburg, certainly, the Burgesses came in, and they would stay in those taverns. Of course, they did drinking and gambling and playing games and such, but the main purpose of the tavern was to stay overnight. But the Grand Lodge of Virginia was started in 1778 with John Blair, Jr., who was a past member of the Williamsburg Lodge, presiding as the first Grand Master. Until recently, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were thought to be Masons as well. But it has since been found that they were not. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems that it is.
I would say that that may or may not be true. And there are so many secret societies. Even if Jefferson wasn't a member of that one, he certainly was a member of others.
I will tell you that some of the greatest names in the American Revolution, however, were Masons. And they would include Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, John Hancock, right. John Paul Jones, and Paul Revere, and many others.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm so sorry to end it here because this is getting very interesting. But, again, we'll have to do a whole show on the vault and all the web of the vault and all of its little strands that go out from there, including the Masons and other secret societies.
Right, well, that would be wonderful.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Bonnie. And everyone, go to her tour. Visit Williamsburg. It's our history. It's America. And her website, again, is www.spooksandlegends.com. Spooksandlegends.com. Thank you, Bonnie, for it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.